Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to today's Football Times from These Football Times. I'm Stephen Scragg, and this is the wrap party. It is the last of the series. We'll be back in August with this particular thread of the These Football Times podcast family, literally, whatever you want to call it. And tonight, our guests are Dave Bowler. Welcome, Dave.
Good evening. We're looking forward to rounding up all the European action of the last week in a bit, or in action in some cases.
Indeed, indeed. And on the opposite side of my screen, sliding in like Luis Diaz tipping up at Anfield for the last couple of games of the season, a welcome return for the wonderful Aidan Williams. Aidan, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Stephen. It's good to be back. It's a homecoming of sorts. It
is.
It's great to be back on.
It is very much welcome home. Very much welcome home. But yeah, brilliant to have you back on, Aidan. Brilliant. We'll throw straight into it. Champions League final less than 24 hours ago. Aidan, certainly from my perspective, I don't know, it was kind of like, I respect what Manchester City have done on the pitch, but obviously there's that shadow off the pitch. And convex to that, three Italians, you know, reaching the three major European finals. I did half feel that, you know, come on, laws of average, Inter are going to do this one, having seen Fiorentina and Roma fall at the final hurdle.
Well, and they were such huge outsiders in the bookies and with most, at least in this country, most commenters prior to the final. And yet they played really, really well, Inter. I thought their tactical approach, given who they were up against in terms of this machine and the, you know, one of the finest tactical minds in modern football in Pep Guardiola, They were excellent. They totally put City off their stride in the first half. I think they had some excellent spells. The way they sort of hassled and pressed them was kind of, well, like City do to others, I suppose. And it really, really put them off. And Edison was all over the place a bit in the first half, hoofing the ball out for a throw-in next to the corner flag and a couple of other strange things. You know, he would have his moments later on. But, you know, overall, I think City were... Yeah, their style isn't always that exciting to watch because it's so utterly dominant and it's so good. Last night, they weren't able to impose that style so much, so it actually made it more of an entertaining game, I think, because it was a bit to and fro, a bit even. You know, they had spells where they had more possession, as you'd expect, but it wasn't crazy. And Inter certainly posed a threat throughout. I think, strangely, Kevin De Bruyne going off actually helped City in some ways because Phil Foden was excellent when he came on. He gave them something they didn't have, seemingly, earlier on. I thought he was really good. But the way City actually won it was through sort of hard graft and sort of hanging on in there at times and sort of forcing the issue rather than with the endless passing, death by a thousand passes kind of approach. But having said all that, they were very, very lucky to actually win it 1-0 into... Oh, they could have equalised more or less straight after. You had a great chance. And then Lukaku had a gilt-edged opportunity that just basically he hit straight into Edison's leg later on. He really should have scored. And then, you know, the save right in the last second from the corner as well. There were some great chances for Inter to equalise. So City were lucky to win it 1-0. But I think overall they weren't necessarily lucky to win as such because I think they were just slightly the better team on the day. But equally, I guess... they are Europe's best team. And I think they've proved that over a period of time, really, coming to this. And they've just managed to screw it up time and time again. I think this season they have shown themselves to be Europe's best. So I guess in terms of that, to win it is just reward. But the actual manner of it and the style of it wasn't what I was expecting, wasn't what lots of people were expecting. And they only scraped over the line, but I think just about deserved to do so.
Hey Dave, the treble won. Where does this place this Manchester City side in the great lexicon of achievement in European football, let alone British football?
It is an extraordinary thing to win everything. that you entered virtually, obviously not the, but the League Cup. Jewel in the Crown obviously have eluded them. They're a great side. I mean, we've had this conversation a few times over the week. They've got every right to be a great side because they've paid for it. The problem with City is for all that they play lovely football all the time, they've got great players and all that, it's very, very difficult to warm to Manchester City. And we'll be having this conversation about Newcastle United in 10 years, Aidan, probably. So
yeah.
Get ready for it. I mean, you know, you're right with the 115 charges hanging over them. And as I said last week, every club that has success generally buys it. I mean, that's the nature, certainly over the last sort of 30, 40 years, that's the nature of modern football, isn't it? You can't blame Manchester City for doing that. And you can't, I don't begrudge the supporters at all. They've been down to the third division. They've been through all kinds of trials and tribulations. So, you know, good luck to them. But it is difficult to feel that any kind of affection for them because it is, you need another centre-forward, right? We'll switch an oil well on for another half an hour and we'll get one. That kind of thing. I mean, it's, I don't know. But in terms of the achievement, for the purists, you'd have to say, in a sense, it's better than Manchester United because they won the league to get into the Champions League, which Manchester United didn't do for 99. So, I mean, you know, there's a sense there that it's better. I think Aidan's right. They are the best team in Europe. I don't think there's much question about that. The way they, you know, they steamrolled Real Madrid in the 4-0 game. They came through Bayern Munich. So they've taken on the best. It's not been an easy run to the final. I think they are up there. But I mean, I was looking at, I think it was Phil McNulty on the BBC today talking about, you know, this is perhaps the best team in European football history. Have they really done anything that has changed the game in the way that Ajax did, for instance, you know, or that Guardiola's Barcelona did, 2009, 2010, whatever it was? I'm not sure that they've advanced the game in any particular exciting way or revolutionary way. They're just incredibly good at it. They've got great players. He coaches them well. They're tactically sound. They seem to have answers for anything that anybody does to them. But I don't know that they've necessarily given us a new dimension of football. And that, I think, is where your greatness lies. So I'm not sure that they quite live up to the greatest of all time. They're just a really well put together, not a machine, because machine implies that they're a bit dreary, a bit boring. But they're, you know, they're incredibly efficient. They know what they're doing. They do better than anybody else, and good luck to them in that sense, I suppose. But I don't know that they will necessarily be spoken of ultimately in the same way as that Barcelona side, that Ajax side.
On the treble thing, sorry, Dave, you say there about comparing with Man United's achievement, and Man United did it without having won the league and so on just prior to it. But at that time in 1999, things were much more of a level playing field.
Absolutely.
So they were up against very strong Italian teams, very strong, very well-resourced, sorry, Italian, Spanish, German teams. Whereas now the inequality that you're alluding to there, if a city can just go out and do what they like, that's extreme. And this, I guess it's the theme when we talk about the Conference League final, you know, it's like rags against riches. That has to be a little question mark in my mind anyway, in terms of the achievement, because of the time it was done in and how, I don't want to say easy, but the Premier League has a huge advantage over all the other leagues because of its financial might. And Manchester City has a huge advantage over the rest of the Premier League because of its financial might. Therefore, it's not quite as hard a task to overcome Europe's finest for City as it was for Manchester United.
Within that, Dave, has the Premier League become kind of what Serie A was in many respects? You know, you look at kind of the Milan of Capello, of Arrigo Sarri, you know, that Italian dominance of European club competitions, certainly across the late 80s, early 90s, into mid-90s, and even stretched towards the tail end of the 1990s. You know, they had the advantages that maybe Manchester City and Premier League, the biggest Premier League clubs have now. You know, have we reached a point where the Premier League is, you know, the Serie A of old almost, that it's the high plateau? As a league, it still doesn't quite attract the, you know, it's never quite had its Lionel Messi, has it? But, you know, are we on the way to that?
I think so. I think it's certainly the clubs with the biggest money And that, I suppose, was one of the great drivers for the Super League concept, you know, that the likes of Juventus and Barcelona and Real Madrid wanted to get their hands on a bit of that, that kind of cash from the same sort of mega TV deal. You know, I think it's unquestionable that the Premier League has that huge advantage. You're right in saying it's never quite got that sort of Messi player at the absolute peak of their powers, and that's one of the things that it's missing. And, you know, I don't know whether the tax regime has got something to do with that in this country compared to other countries. But if you're a fan of an English team, that's a great thing. I'm not sure in the wider context of the game that it's healthy, in the same way that Serie A thing in the 80s into the 90s was particularly healthy. You know, we talked the other week about Bayern Munich winning the 11th title in a row, and you know we're looking at the Premier League clubs having that same kind of dominance in European competition. And that's never a good thing. You want to spread it around. You want to get different clubs winning things, different countries winning things, and different ways of playing. And, you know, I think we're coming to a point where, you know, the idea of the playing from the back, the possession football, that's becoming as dreary as the Route 1 football was in its way in the 80s, because it's everybody does exactly the same damn thing. I thought it was interesting that last sort of 20 minutes. It's not often that a European Cup final or Champions League final puts me in mind of Graham Taylor, but that one did, because that last 20 minutes, what Inter did essentially was put a big fella up front, lump the ball forward a bit, put it in the mixer, as Ron Atkinson would have doubtless said if he'd been on CoComs, and see what happened. And Manchester City didn't like it very much. You know, the one against the bar, the goalkeeper saved one with his knee where he's got no idea what he's doing. And makes a brilliant save in the last seconds. When Inter stopped doing the fancy stuff and the high pressing and all of that, and just thought, right, what we'll do is we'll play like Watford and lump it into the front and see what Luther Blissett can score us a goal. They were pretty close to getting it back, and that's an interesting idea for, you know, clubs next season against Manchester City. Maybe they don't like it up them, as they used to say in Dad's Army.
They are vulnerable in a couple of ways. I mean, that's obviously one way, because they're just not used to facing that that style for much, much time. The other way is what Brentford has shown this season. You know, they've beaten them twice. Okay, one of them was when City were just on a wind down, preparing for other things. But the way they'd done it was bypassing the press almost like, and just getting through with pace. And that's the other vulnerability to the sort of high line defensive attacking, high pressing approach that they have. So yeah, there are ways to beat them. But there's an awful lot of people who think they've gone in with a great plan. It's like Mike Tyson, isn't it? Everyone's got a plan until they're punched in the nose. And that it's pretty much the same against City. You know, most people have got a great plan, but hardly anyone can actually pull it off. I don't know where you think they stand, Stephen, because obviously you're a fan of a team with a glorious European pedigree. Where does this achievement sit in your mind?
I think Alex Ferguson always used to say it, didn't he, that the great teams win it repetitively, or they win a cluster of them within the short space of time. And I think he always lamented that his Manchester United never quite did that following success in either 99 or 2008. And I think there's a lot to be said for that, because, you know, we'll look at European Cup success, you know, and kind of Champions League as well. And everyone, you know, the reset images of Real Madrid winning the first five, it's, you know, back-to-back wins for Benfica, and then you lose the final at the third time of asking. There's back-to-back wins for Inter. You know, there's the rise of Ajax. There's Bayern Munich. Liverpool's, what, four successes in seven seasons. Forest back-to-back. You know, Milan's, you know, successes between, what was it, 89 and 94, coming one after another with finals lost as well amongst that period of time, all the way up to 95. So, yeah, you know, and the contemporary Real Madrid as well, you know, having won a set of them once again. You know, that's the trick for Manchester City now, is to go out there and win a couple more, really, you know, within the next couple of years as well. That would maybe cement, you know, a bit more respect than they currently get. You know, they are the easy punch bag in so many ways, and it's finding a way to stop people viewing in that respect, really. I think I'll be interested to see where they go next season. You know, that kind of, like, well, now they've won three successive Premier League titles. No team has won four successive English titles, whether that's the first division of the Football League or the Premier League. No, three is the most that's been won. They've just won the treble, emulating Manchester United. So it will be interesting to see whether they can avoid hitting that wall next season, which often comes after, you know, climbing the mountain, scaling the mountain. That will be quite a big ask for Manchester City to pick themselves back up again, you know, having put that effort in to do what they've done this season, you know, and repeat it, you know, or to go out there and, you know, and keep that hunger going. That's the big trick now for them. And within that, you know, maybe there is a glimmer of an opportunity for someone next season. So, yeah, you know, I think next season and just what they follow this up with will be what will be very interesting to see. But, Aidan, on the opposite side of that coin, Italy, Serie A's given a fantastic season, really. They're on the pitch, off the pitch, it's still dysfunctional. You know, it's never got that kind of, you know, the finances of old. It's not got the pull of old. You know, the best players in Serie A will be preyed upon. But, you know, they might hang around, but, you know, there's the opportunity that, you know, people are looking at Napoli and their success and the fact that, you know, suddenly kind of like the biggest checkbooks might well swoop on their best players. You know, there's a reverse in that respect to how Serie A used to be. But, you know, we're looking at four back-to-back seasons now with four different league titles, champions. You know, Italian side has reached every single major European final this season. Yes, they've fallen short. Do you see Italian clubs coming again next season, or do you think this is the plateau and they maybe fall back into, you know, what has been, I don't know, kind of underachievement for the last decade and a half, really?
It's an interesting one because it has over the last few years, hasn't it? Of they hadn't had anyone in the latter stages of the Champions League, I don't think, in terms of the real pointy end, until this one for a little while. Roma had their success last year, I think, didn't they, in the Conference League? But it's been few and far between for a while, which is odd for people of our generation to think of the strength of Italian football. I think what it shows, though, part of what you're saying there about the different league champions is a really healthy league that's growing and improving again and is competitive. Okay, I guess that might be an odd statement given how many points Napoli won the league by this season. Maybe that isn't that competitive after all. But the sort of rotation through teams capable of winning it is equally. Inter, they finished, what, 17, 18 points behind Napoli, something along those lines. And yet have come really close in a Champions League final. They showed that they were superior to their City rivals, who only finished a couple of points behind them in the league when they played them in the semi-final of the Champions League. They won the Coppa Italia. So they're a strong force that you could see growing from here. I'm really intrigued to see how Napoli get on next year in the Champions League as well, given they've had a good, strong couple of seasons, but this season has just been exceptional. This season just gone. It will hinge entirely, though, on finances of whether they get to keep those players, notably Osimhen and the Georgian fella whose name I won't try and pronounce. If they lose both of those, or even possibly just one, if it's Osimhen in particular, I think they may sink back to being just, I don't know, able to get to the quarterfinals or something like that rather than really push on. That would be a shame because it would be great to see them get the sort of just desserts or the just reward, if you like, for having had such a great season. They've already got a major reward in their third ever Scudetto, of course, but to actually then go the next step, which they never could before. Even in Maradona's days, they never quite managed to conquer the biggest mountain in Europe. It would be lovely to see. I think, though, it's pure economics shows that it's probably going to be a short-lived revival in terms of European competition. But that shouldn't necessarily be such a disaster for Italian football because I think overall the picture is healthy. I think the entertainment quality has gone really up in the last few years. I think, you know, all the old stereotypes are long gone. We've discussed this with Adam Summerton on a couple of occasions of how entertaining Serie A has been lately. The way the teams are playing, their approach, their sort of more attacking outlook, married with that strong tactical awareness that they always have. Makes it an entertaining product, which the Premier League may not be able to always match if it's several divisions within one, more so than other leagues perhaps. So I think Napoli will be a bit of a barometer next season to see how Italy's strongest can cope with Europe's best. But don't forget, Inter were a long way behind them, were Italy's third best, and have just run Manchester City awfully close in the Champions League final. So that should give hope that the likes of Napoli could progress far next year. But I really hope they do.
I mean, Dave, I mean, I think Inter's run to the final, you know, how well Napoli have done this season domestically. You know, AC Milan's success in Serie A last season, as you know, Aidan's mentioned, Roma's success in the Conference League last year, reached the Europa League final this year. A lot of this, you know, these rises and these you know, achievements by the Italian teams have been based upon intelligence and clever use of the transfer market, loans, and basically coming to the drawing board and coming up with a compelling kind of, you know, framework from which they can you know, achieve and to play. This offers hope. I mean, I've seen a little bit of this at Liverpool. You know, Liverpool's kind of like growth was based upon, you know, largely selling Philip Coutinho and reinvesting, and you know, a little bit of kind of like Lovejoy about it in, you know, selling the teapot to buy the table and the dresser, that type of thing. You know, this is a type of occurrence with Inter and Serie A this season that has to give hope to, I don't know, not just other Italian clubs, but clubs across the rest of Europe.
Yeah, I think when you haven't got a bottomless pit of money, you have to do a bit more thinking, don't you? I mean, it's obvious you've got to either be capable of bringing players through from your own youth system that are going to come and make a difference in your first team, or you've got to pick out the right loan players, or pick out the diamonds that are coming through in smaller leagues perhaps, and get them earlier than the Manchester Cities and the Liverpools and the Manchester Uniteds do and the Barcelonas do. And that's been a facet, I think, of Italian football in the last three or four seasons. I mean, even with somebody like Mourinho, I mean, by and large, you know, since he went to Chelsea the first time, he's been a checkbook manager. You know, he's been able to bring in the players that he wants whenever he wants. And going to Roma, it's been a slightly different situation. And for all that, perhaps he didn't cover himself in glory last week in the final, shall we say. But it's been an interesting development in the way that he's managed, and he's you know, I think he's proven a few things in that sense by being able to produce a Roma side that has got to finals in Europe. That's an achievement, you know. I think, you know, the difficulty with the Premier League is he's so awash with money, and we've talked about this the last few weeks about the end of the Premier League season. It always seems to be the answer to everything is let's spend a bigger amount of money than we did last month. Last transfer window, we'll spend more and more, and so therefore we will inevitably get better. And firstly, that's not true, because, you know, there are plenty of transfers that end up disastrously because they haven't been thought through properly. But equally, you know, if you're in a league where you can spend 50 million quid, well, there's probably 15 clubs that can spend 80 million quid. So, it, you know, you're not really getting anywhere anyway off the back of that. I think the Premier League's ultimate downfall, although it doesn't seem to be coming anytime soon, given that they've just picked up two of the European trophies, but its ultimate downfall will be that it becomes so comfortable in the amount of money it can spend. And ultimately, that will just see that money spent badly, badly, badly. And there'll be people doing a bit more thinking elsewhere, being a bit smarter about what they do. You know, necessity is the mother of invention and all of that. And that they'll find a way through. You know, I mean, if you look at the two teams last night, you go down the Manchester City team and then you go down the Inter Milan team. How many from Inter are going to get into that Manchester City team if you're picking your fantasy 11 from that? Well, probably not very many of them, if any. But they gave them a hell of a game because they were well set up. They knew what they were doing. They worked extremely hard. And they're gifted players. They're clearly gifted players. That difference between them in the end wasn't huge, and another day that, you know, the looping header is 12 inches lower and it goes in the back of the net. Or Edison's knees and quite as big as it looks, and, you know, Lukaku puts it past him. That, those are the fine margins. Now, it doesn't matter how much money you spend if Inter Milan put together a good team and work intelligently and you know, have a good tactical plan. They've shown what you can do. Hopefully, as you say, the acid test is, can they keep those teams together? Can Napoli keep their team together? Can Inter keep their team together? And then go on and build. That's the problem, because, you know, if Real Madrid or Barcelona or Manchester City want one of those players, one of their key players, they'll come and have them and pay them a lot more money. And then you're back to square one again. But I think what they've shown is that they've got the nous to do it, you know, and that there's no reason why they won't come again. But having to come again is a cycle, you know, and it's another couple of years down the line, and you've got to put that team together again, and you get one, on that basis, you get one crack at it. Those aren't great odds.
I mean, the good part in that, though, Aidan, is that the stock has risen dramatically. So when teams come calling for the players of Inter, of Napoli, you know, it's like at Milan, Leao has just signed a new contract. So, you know, he will take a lot of money now to procure from Milan. You know, the stock has risen. So the asking price will obviously rise as well. You know, Napoli have just won the Serie A title on the back of losing Koulibaly, of Insigne moving on. You know, they've not blinked. They've gone out and reinvested wisely and run away with the title. You know, they are, at the very least, in a strong bargaining position when it comes to kind of like retaining or moving their players on.
In terms of transfer fees, probably yes, but in terms of wages they can offer, I would imagine not. And that's where it might go awry. But at least I guess they might get more compensation than they would have done otherwise. It has been, I guess it's quite remarkable for Italian side to make it to all three finals and come away with no trophy at all. But it is symbolic of the general strength of Italian football currently. And that is a positive. As you say, or as you both mentioned, you know, losing a star player doesn't necessarily have to mean the end of it if it's dealt with wisely in terms of how that's reinvested, how it's spent. Maybe a little more effort has to go in than the Premier League teams would have to do in terms of identifying talent who can be bought more cheaply but will make similar impact rather than just throwing money at whatever the latest fad is. So I guess it's harder work that way, but they're showing that these teams are showing that they can do that. Napoli have certainly shown that with spectacular success. So hopefully that will continue, and it will continue to flourish as a strong league, but one that can compete in Europe as well. But yeah, I think at the end of the day, they may get a little more transfer fee, but when wages come into question, it's going to be hard for them to compete.
Dave, as Aidan said, the three Italian teams reaching the three major European finals, they have all lost, but they've lost by narrow margins there. You know, slender one goal defeat for Inter in the Champions League final, a penalty shootout made the difference between Roma and Sevilla. And Fiorentina lost to a late sucker punch to West Ham. You know, none of these three Italian sides in the major European finals have been walked all over.
You could make a case in all three where, you know, the Italian side would have won. You know, that late flurry from Inter yesterday could have unhinged City. They could have gone on into extra time, won the game. I mean, the West Ham Fiorentina game was nothing really to choose between them, to be perfectly honest. I don't think over the 90 minutes you could argue that Fiorentina were the better side. And then, although Roma, very definitely Mourinho to the final. Again, nothing in it. Take it all the way to penalties on another day. They win the penalty shootout. Yeah, I mean, these are the, as European finals go, these are the tightest margins that we've had in a long time, I think. You know, a last-minute winner for West Ham, or virtually last-minute penalty shootout, and a 1-0 in the Champions League final. Nothing in it at all. They can all take a great deal of optimism into next season, I think, in the European competitions. You know, obviously, it depends on what their squads look like when we come to kicking off again for next season, and who's stayed, who's gone, who they've brought in, what managers have moved around, all that kind of stuff. It's difficult to say from this point, but there's every reason to suspect that there'll be a couple of Italian finalists again next year in Europe. There's no reason to think otherwise. What'll be interesting for them domestically is, you know, with Juventus missing out on Europe altogether. Will that make them a more potent force in Serie A because they've got nothing else to think about? Or will that loss of money really give them some proper wilderness years a bit lower down? You know, who knows how that's going to play out. But I think the competitiveness of the league, okay, Napoli have run away with it, but if you look over the last 4 years, four different winners, that's a competitive playing field, isn't it? And I think that only adds to their ability in European competition because, you know, none of those games are taken for granted at league level, at domestic level. When it's tight like that, you've got to, you know, you have to find something extra to win games. I think that stands them in good stead in Europe, and perhaps is a reason why some of our bigger teams from the Premier League haven't particularly done particularly well in European competition because they're ahead of the game so much with so many of the teams in our league.
Aidan, going back to Manchester City for our final point, reports of problems for the supporters, herded onto the buses to the Ataturk, told to avoid the metro system, accusations of being treated like cattle, supporters in wheelchairs reportedly struggling across the rocky terrain, free-for-all outside the Ataturk after the game as far as trying to get back on buses to get back to the centre of Istanbul, which is like 18 miles from the Ataturk to the centre of Istanbul. You know, reports of supporters being charged anything up to €300 for a taxi to get back, to take them back. And people are talking of not being allowed into the hotels until 3 a.m. in the morning. You know, another stain on UEFA there. I mean, I have experience of Istanbul from 2005. There are, you know, from what has been mentioned, a lot of familiar sounding issues there. You know, I well remember the rocky terrain outside the Ataturk. I remember the buses. Saying the Ataturk is in Istanbul is like taking everyone to Liverpool for European final, but playing the game, you know, at Wigan, you know, or Ewood Park even. It's very, very, very familiar stories coming back from Manchester City fans.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a strange choice. I mean, the stadium itself is impressive and fine, but, you know, there's a lot more to it than that on an event like this. And, you know, I'm sure certain things came back to your mind, Stephen, from events last year as well, where there's various stories of people having to pass through tight bottlenecks and so on. And obviously, thankfully, it didn't quite reach the extremes that it did for you last year. But, you know, lessons clearly aren't ever learned. It was chaotic by all accounts, purely in the organization. You know, there was things that I've seen about how there was hardly any water available for sale. Or if you did want to buy any, you had to queue up for about 45 minutes or an hour. There was hardly any toilet facilities, things like this. I mean, this is your showpiece event. But once again, what it shows is the people who matter least are those who sort of make the product for UEFA. You know, where would the product, if you want to call it that, be without the fans of each team shunted to each end rather than with the prime seats, of course? Where would it be without them, without the displays, without the flags, without their noise? It wouldn't be remotely the same. And yet they're treated with contempt time and time again. Given that they'd had this final in Istanbul, in this Istanbul stadium in 2005, all of these infrastructure difficulties, if you like, were known about. As you say, nothing's changed on those fronts. The difficulty of travelling seems to be worse. I don't know if the metro was something that wasn't there back then that is now, but it seems that people were told not to use the metro and to use these buses. The only people who managed to get back to Istanbul in a reasonable way were those who ignored that advice, from what I've been reading. It just seems utterly astonishing. But then the organisational problems that obviously happened last year in Paris didn't happen to the same extent, but there were cases. So, you know, things like that, it's so, so disappointing that they keep happening. Stadium choices might come into mention for the Conference League as well, because it was far too small for a final which had two well-supported teams. But in this case, the Istanbul one, it's nothing to do with the stadium itself and the size, just simply where it is and what's around it. There's so many other stadiums they could have picked. Even in Istanbul itself, there are several other stadiums they could have picked. You know, I assume this was staying in Istanbul because it was meant to be there the other year, and it got taken away during COVID. But, you know, Galatasaray, Fenerbahce, these stadiums are impressive stadiums. I'm sure they could host it far better in terms of locale and facilities than the Ataturk if they want to go to Istanbul. There's no reason not to play a final in Istanbul at all. It doesn't have to be a Western thing, but there are better choices in that city, I'm quite sure.
Dave, UEFA, slow in getting the putting the house in order?
Slow is a very nice understatement. It's just every time, isn't it? There's something, you know. I mean, thankfully, it seems that there weren't the dangers to life in the sense that we've had, you know, obviously with the Liverpool situation last year. It's an increasing thing that stadiums are built out of town, out of city, basically, I suppose, because of the cheapness of the land, by and large, for new stadiums. It just seems a very peculiar thing, and that's okay when you know it's a domestic issue. If you're asking people from other countries to come somewhere else in Europe, and then, okay, they come to Istanbul, and then they've got to find their way to this stadium 20, 30 miles away. And that could be, we're not talking just about, as Aidan says, it's not a question of Turkey or whatever, but it's of any of these out of city stadiums. To make all those numbers of people, thousands and thousands of people who've never probably been to that country before, probably never been to that city before, probably don't speak the language of the countries. I think if you're going to have a European final, you want to make it as easy as possible for everybody to get there. And above all else, you've got to have it's got to be a safe stadium and all those things. But all the infrastructure thing has got to be right as well. Now you're bringing in, what was it, 60,000 last night was the attendance. Getting that 60,000 people who probably all flew into Istanbul, by and large, you would think, getting them to then have to find their way elsewhere. I mean, first of all, you're just asking for trouble, aren't you? You're just making life very, very difficult for everybody. Then, as Aidan says, that in baking hot conditions, you can't get a bottle of water. Well, that's pretty basic, isn't it? I mean, Aberdeen, they've qualified for Europe next season, and they will play in either the Conference League or the Europa League in the group stages, whichever way the playoffs go, through till Christmas. Now, they'll play four games at home in the end. And they've got a list of stuff from UEFA, as long as you're on, of things that they've got to do for their stadium to make it, inhabitable. For these four relatively low-key games that are going to attract relatively small audiences of travelling support, because they're going to be midweek in October, November, December. And the amount of stuff they've got to do is ridiculous. Meanwhile, you can have successive Champions League finals in locations or in stadiums that aren't fit for purpose with an infrastructure around it. That doesn't make any sense to me. Somebody somewhere is taking a very large amount of money for doing not very much, it would appear. Which, and I'm sure in the modern day comes as a great surprise to everybody. But, at some point, as we always say, at some point something has to change. I don't know who it is that changes it, because, you change your heads at the top of the tree. And nothing gets any better, does it? That's the problem. Nothing ever seems to get any better. Lessons will be learned. Well, when? Is there any chance you could do it now?
Great point. I mean, as a supporter that's been around to the Champions League finals, Istanbul, Athens, Kiev, Madrid, Paris. The big thing in common with them is that the people themselves in the cities are wonderful. They welcome you with open arms. And being in the city itself has been a magnificent thing, and Istanbul was absolutely, probably one of the warmest cities I've ever been to. And from my perspective, it's never about, the city themselves. It's never about the people who inhabit those cities that make you so welcome and that can, can't do more for you if they tried. it does come down to the organisation, and the key organisation, unfortunately, will be the local authorities. They will be UEFA themselves, and often, you know, the clubs involved in these games, you know, will be set to a brace position just as much as the supporters will. And yeah, you know, I think on the plus side, the next two finals, Wembley and Munich, you know, you'd like to think that UEFA can at least get those two right. But the thing is, you wouldn't put it past them to get it badly wrong. You know, we only have to look at the final, or the delayed final of Euro 2020, and the chaos outside Wembley Stadium. You know, again, a UEFA, you know, run tournament where, you know, the organisation is just utterly woeful. But yes, sad to see that there were issues for Manchester City fans, and I'm sure as well for Inter fans as well, amongst all that too, because, you know, I cast it back a year ago, so much, you know, light was cast upon the problems that we had as Liverpool supporters, but Madrid fans had their own problems as well, amongst all that, that shouldn't go forgotten. Moving on to Europa League final, Sevilla prospered. They prevailed in the penalty shootout against Roma. Dave, this was an intriguing game. Roma, you know, with everything that surrounded it, the kitchen sink drama of Mourinho losing his shit, you know, Anthony Taylor, you know, absolutely alienating anyone of a Roma persuasion, being tapped in the, you know, in the airport, which was sad to see. No matter how controversial a referee is, you don't want to see, you know, under siege, especially with family, you know, surrounded by him as well. And amongst all this as well, Sevilla, that is quite the story as well. You know, having been in the bottom three for the first half of the season, their issues earlier in the campaign where they sack a manager who eventually tips up at Wolves. a peculiar set of dominoes falling in Sevilla's favour. And this, you know, stunning kitchen sink drama of Roma.
I think even by Mourinho standards, getting a red card in a car park is pretty impressive. I mean, I don't think even he's managed that before. I don't know. I don't know where you start with him. I mean, he's kind of entertaining, but I think that's worn off now. I mean, you know, once upon a time it was this siege mentality and everybody hates us and, you know, the world is set against me and all that kind of thing. I mean, it was kind of entertaining when he first came to Chelsea and did a bit of that. How old is he now? I mean, God, he's my age. I would hate to be quite as embarrassed. Perhaps I am as embarrassing as that. I don't know. You have to ask my family. But I would hate to be as embarrassing as that on the world stage. That's for damn sure. There comes a point, surely, when your manager's behaving like that, for all the positives that he carries with him, he's doing your club a disservice and he's making life more difficult for his players to go out and win. You know, I know the siege mentality. You know, I've spoken to many managers and many footballers from many different clubs over the years, and they've all talked about, you know, the inner sanctum and the dressing room and nobody can touch us in there, and, you know, that it's us against the world and all of that sort of stuff. And that's one thing, but to go and behave the way he did all the way through that game, and then to carry it on afterwards and be just an absolute clown towards the referee and all of that stuff. There comes a point where there has to be some greater sanction, surely. But there never seems to be. And I don't, you know, talking about UEFA, no lessons are learned. Well, I don't suppose Mourinho's ever going to learn any lessons at this late stage in his act. But you're right about Sevilla. I mean, I remember I think it must have been in and around the World Cup time, we were doing one of these, talking about Sevilla as the crisis club and how it had all gone terribly wrong and it was all falling apart, and what a shame it was that this great club that had all this magnificent success was going to end up getting relegated. And that didn't quite work out, did it? I think most people in the end would be glad that they won it by whatever method that it took to win it in the end. But it's not it wasn't an edifying spectacle, and it's not a final that's going to go down in history for it. Well, not for any of the right reasons anyway, is it?
Aidan, an infamous final more than anything.
Very much so. I think mean, Mourinho, he's become like, it's like he's a parody of himself now, you know, as though he's living up to his own stereotype or something, that he has to push it even further all the time. It's utterly crazy. But yeah, it wasn't an aesthetically pleasing final, but I think the way it turned out in the end was glorious. The fact that Roma, well, to start with, were so poor at their penalties, that was a little bit satisfying too. But then when Montiel, of course, who scored the winning penalty in the World Cup final penalty shootout for Argentina only a few months before, when his first effort was saved, to then give him the chance to take it again, correctly so, you know, the Roma keeper had stepped off his line prior to the kick, so you know it was the correct decision. But I think that's like taking the open wound of Mourinho's anger and pouring a ton of salt in there and stamping on his head for good measure. I think that was a beautiful conclusion. There was no way Montiel was ever going to miss his second effort. Watching on, we just knew how it was going to go. And that was delightfully pleasing, I think, under the circumstances. Some people who are more inclined to favour Mourinho than others might take a different view. But I think many of us fans of Schadenfreude and seeing comeuppance for people who just can't stop bickering and whining and going on. Sevilla weren't angels either themselves. They contributed. But you know, there were levels, and Roma took it slightly further. And then to do the things after the game, like Dave was mentioning, like the hounding Anthony Taylor in the car park, I would say was a direct there's a direct correlation between that and what then happened with the fans at the airport. You know, if the manager is seen to be acting that way, the fans could be said to be taking their lead from him in that regard. And it's horrible to see. There should be some sort of punishment for that, but as you both said, there likely won't be. I guess it would have happened by now if there was going to be, which is a shame. But Sevilla, I think it's such a wonderful, wonderful story with the Europa League. Of course, they were in the Champions League, finished third, deliberately probably, to see their way to glory. It'll be interesting to see what happens next year, because of course they've earned themselves a Champions League spot again. Spain will have 5 as a result, I think. And who would bet against them coming third in their group and forcing their way through the Europa League again? It seems like for a club of that size and stature, finishing third in the Champions League group is actually a good plan in some ways, because it actually leaves you with something you could realistically aim to win. I don't think anyone would think Sevilla would be good enough to go to those depths in the Champions League. But in the Europa League, they proved again and again that they are. With the Sevilla connections, it'll be interesting too how Aston Villa get on in the Conference League, because they're obviously got themselves a manager who was part of Sevilla's winning past in Europe. So that would be quite interesting to see as well, how that works out. But yeah, it was delightful to see Sevilla overcome. I felt slightly bad for a couple of Roma's players, Abraham and Smalling, who nearly scored towards the end as well. I think because they've been sort of brave to some way to push themselves beyond the comfort zone and gone and sought pastures new, I admire that in them. So I felt a bit bad for them, but that was only momentary. I didn't feel too bad.
Dave, Sevilla, incredible in this competition. 7 times UEFA Cup / Europa League winners, never lost a final. As Aidan said, into the Champions League next season from 12th position in La Liga, from the bottom 3 at Christmas, I think it was, certainly going into the new year. I think there's never quite been such a left field kind of, not left field team, but you know, a left field qualifier for the Champions League as such.
It is pretty remarkable to get into the Champions League via that route, but. As Aidan says, I mean, you know, clearly they're going to be back into the Europa League next season. In fact, you might as well be starting engraving the trophy now for next year, because I'm sure they'll come through. I mean, it does make you think about the Champions League, because it is certainly, if you're one of those teams, a more sensible strategy to finish third in your group and give yourself a chance of going on and actually winning something. You know, making a play to win something. You could argue that they shouldn't get that consolation prize, having finished third in the Champions League. I think that's a perfectly reasonable argument because, you know, you enter one competition, you see it through, and if you don't win it, you don't win it. I'm not sure that it's great that they drop down into the second division halfway through the season and get the chance to go on and win something. But their record is just absolutely ludicrous, isn't it, over the last 18, 19 years in that competition or its various variants over the piece. I mean, it's like Real Madrid at the start of the European Cup. It's just absolutely extraordinary the way they manage to just keep reeling off win after win after win, season after season. And it's a great story, you know. As you say, back earlier on in the season, it all seemed as though that glorious era was over, and then, you know, they come through and they carry off the trophy again, and you know, they beat the pantomime villain at the death, and as Aidan says, the penalty shootout was, you know, it was like a sitcom. It was hilarious. It was I mean, all the things that you would want out of a final, really, in the end, you got from that penalty shootout. So I don't know. I'm pleased. I was pleased that they won it, full stop. But particularly pleased after the way that the game went. And I mean, Aidan's right about the stuff at the airport as well. I mean, that has to be based on the way that the managers behave. I'm never overly sold on this idea about players and managers and so on being role models and all that kind of stuff and being an example. But I mean, that equally, there are some boundaries that you don't step over. And Mourinho just lives without any consequences. And the supporters clearly must take a lead from that. And after this, surely there has got to be some proper consequence for this. I mean, not a, you know, £50,000 fine or a four game touchline ban or something. There's got to be something, you know, properly significant about it. I don't know quite how that works, but you can't have this year after year after year, and particularly when it's revolving around referees. You know, I mean, we all have our views on various referees, but they're doing their job as honestly as they can. You know, that's whether they're any good at it or not is another story. But you know, they're doing an honest job as well as they can. They're not, you know, they're entitled not to be attacked in that kind of way. But I suspect nothing will be done.
On the opposite side of this coin, Roma, I mean, we've spoken of very, very little sympathy for them as far as their comeuppance in the final or the outcome of the final for them, should we say. But they have played some very good football this season at times. Yeah, from mid-April, from third in mid-April, they went seven without a win until scraping a victory on the final night at home to Spezia. You know, Aidan, this almost smacked of, I don't know, Roma putting all their eggs in one basket and trying to win the Europa League when Champions League qualification was actually in the palm of the hand, you know, 6 weeks before the end of the season.
For all his ills, Mourinho is someone who likes to aim for the tangible reward, for the glory. He likes to count his trophies, so much so that he counts the Community Shield. But that's admirable, because that's what it should be about. That's what sport is about. That's what football is about. His chairman may have preferred him to go for securing the top four, and maybe that shift of priority might have hampered the European campaign this time around. But winning a trophy is something to actually celebrate, rather than, you know, here's me talking as a Newcastle person and you know, we've celebrated finishing fourth, which was, you know, something that was beyond most people's imaginations, of course. But would the celebrations have been more vigorous and enjoyable and memorable had they won the Carabao Cup rather than finished fourth? I would think so, because that's a trophy. That's something tangible and it's something that won't get taken back. Finishing fourth, all that does is get you into competition that you're probably not going to win. Let's be honest. It might get a bit more cash, it gets a bit more prestige and so on, but it doesn't get you that glory. This is something that the inverted quote marks lesser European competitions can give teams. And we'll come on to the Conference League in a bit, but I think that's something that has actually, for all it sounds, a daft name, and for all it didn't start off with the best of rap. I think it's something that's been quite positive and working quite well for teams of that stature. Those who are willing to go for it and go for victory and not worry that they're not winning the most prestigious competition, but they're actually going for glory. I think that's good. I think that's admirable. So I think, yes, Roma as a club may have looked in a better position and progressed further long term, perhaps, had they qualified for the Champions League and pushed on from there. Probably there'll be a few envious glances across at Lazio, who are, of course, in the Champions League next season. But if they'd been able to win this trophy, to add to the one they won the year before in Europe as well, that would have been a legacy for the club and Mourinho himself, I suppose. Something to actually look at, something shiny in the cabinet to see. That's better than finishing fourth in my book.
A fantastic point and a fantastic point. Well put there. Dave, you've got to agree with Aidan's sentiment there. I think he's nailed it there. I think from a Newcastle perspective, they would have preferred to have won the, you know, if they had to have taken the choice of winning the League Cup or finishing fourth for a Champions League place, it is that silverware. You know, you do have to respect that side of Mourinho in going for the pot rather than just the, you know, Zadok the priest.
You don't get the open top bus head for finishing fourth, do you? That's the point. You know, I think you don't get your picture around the stadium for avoiding relegation or for qualifying for the Champions League. You get your picture around the stadium when you're holding up a trophy. And Aidan's absolutely right with that. I mean, what Mourinho's done all the way through, you know, when he came to Chelsea, the first thing he did was, right, we're going to win the League Cup because it's the first thing we can win, and it's a trophy, and, you know, here we are. We've done something. We've achieved something. I think that's absolutely right. That is what football, to us, you know, us mere punters, that's what football is about. You want some glory. You want the great day out at Wembley, or you want the, you know, you want to win the league. You want the, if you're in the lower divisions, you want that promotion party at the end of the season. All those things. Those are the things that matter. Those are the things you remember. You don't remember, oh well, we finished fourth, and then we went into the Champions League, and we got beat five times, and that was the end of that by Christmas. You know, great. So what? I suppose in the bigger picture, qualifying for the Champions League perhaps attracts a better class of player, and perhaps moves your club further on down the line a little bit. But no, you want to see somebody spraying champagne all over the place like an idiot? That's how the season's supposed to end. That's what you want.
Exactly. And like I was saying, Aidan, I mean, that is one side of Mourinho you know that has to be applauded. His antics seem to have scared PSG off. However, PSG were reputedly sniffing around him and have backed off somewhat, focusing their attention on Julian Nagelsmann at the minute, reputedly. Within that, though, Roma's defeat might have been the way of Roma keeping hold of Mourinho. You know, it might have been the time, you know, had he won the Europa League for Roma, he might have been tempted to bow out with another option on the table.
I'm sure he would have loved a crack at the Champions League based on having won the Europa League. For all we're saying about the finishing third or fourth, that would have been a great way that he would have loved to have gone at it. But I don't know. He does seem universally popular amongst Roma fans, like he was at Inter before when he was in Italy previously. He does seem to have a way, by whatever means he does it, of galvanising a fan base at times. It doesn't seem to work everywhere, though, as Tottenham fans, I'm sure, will attest, and Manchester United, I would presume. I don't know. He's such a divisive character. Maybe it's akin to certain players who you love to hate, but if they're yours, you kind of, you know, they're a bastard, but they're our bastard, you know, that kind of thing. I can see there being an element of that, but I guess this is borne out throughout his career, that only lasts so long before it becomes tiresome. All the bickering, all the arguments, less stylish football, possibly at times, that's all fine if it's effective and wins. You can put up with all of that and nobody minds, but if it doesn't produce success, or if it sees you sliding down the league, then people soon get sick of it. And he seems to get sick of it and engineer his own exit usually as well, by causing greater and greater eruptions. It would have been hilarious, I think, had he gone to PSG. I just don't see that they go well together, the club and what it's trying to do, and Mourinho. I don't know. Mourinho, Mbappe, Neymar in a room together yelling at each other just seems, well, either glorious or awful. I'm not quite sure which. Whether it would have produced anything harmonious on the pitch, I'm really not sure. So maybe they're better off that he hasn't gone there. But yes, it's always interesting to see where he pitches up. But one thing's for sure is he'll never stay anywhere for too long.
And that's the thing, though, isn't it, Dave? He doesn't, you know, he's kind of like a football. You know, his football's great anti-hero in contemporary terms, but, you know, he's kind of like an anti-hero slash littlest hobo. You know, he is that, you know, magnificent theme tune. He's off down the road again. But, you know, the thing is that you look across the span of his managerial career, he's never spent any more than 3 years at any one club. And even then, 3 years is the maximum he's done. He did 3 years in his first spell at Chelsea, did 3 years at Real Madrid. If he completes a full, well, if he stays at Roma to start with, if he's back at Roma next season, he will be going into his third season. As Aidan said, he does seem to have found a bit of a home. It's somewhere he seems to feel at home and quite comfortable. The fans seem to adore him. And, you know, this is, as we mentioned earlier, you know, having been a checkbook manager, you know, I'd always wanted to see Mourinho in a job like this where he had to, I don't know, come up with a plan that wasn't just a case of write another big check. You know, I think if the union stays intact between Roma and Mourinho, they've half a chance of being in that title hunt next season. You know, but Mourinho, you know, if he was to do, I don't know, I mean, because he's become tarnished in a way, you know, is you know, he went to Manchester United, yes, he won the Europa League, won the League Cup with them, went to Tottenham, you know, the first job he'd left without winning anything. You know, he dropped down from that echelon of being part of the grade A coaches to being there amongst the I don't know, the peloton as such, you know, talking all things, you know, Tour de France before the podcast. You know, I don't know, would it be his great redemption if he could turn, you know, Roma into Serie A contenders / winners?
It would be a remarkable turnaround given his career arc and the third year and all of that sort of stuff, which always seems to end up in ending tears. I mean, in a way, he kind of, what he builds is like a crazy gang with O levels, really. I mean, it's that same mentality, isn't it? You know, that everybody hates us, the world's against us. We'll go out and show them. Perhaps in Rome, you know, the gladiatorial element of all of that. Perhaps that sits well with the local populace. He does, as you say, he does seem to be remarkably popular there, and he does seem to be a fit. He seems to be a good fit there. As we were saying earlier, with such a competitive league as Serie A, you can see another team coming out of the pack and causing trouble at the top end of the division. There's no reason why they couldn't go on and do really well next season. But it is just so against his character, so against everything that he's done in the past before. I mean, you know, perhaps before all the shenanigans of the final, you might have thought, well, perhaps he's getting a bit older, perhaps he's mellowing a bit, and perhaps he's learning a bit, and perhaps he's, you know, perhaps this time he might be able to settle down and get the best out of people for a third year, and maybe even a fourth year. And then he behaves, you know, the way he behaves there. And you think, well, no, he hasn't changed much, has he? And so you have to start thinking that there is no logical reason to suggest that he's finally going to get over his third year problem, is there? That's the thing. There's nothing there on the table that says, well, this is a changed man. This is a fella who has learned from his mistakes and all that kind of stuff, and can go and, you know, now galvanise a team in a third year. Particularly given that he was openly touting himself for a job, you know, 3 or 4 weeks ago before all the Europa League stuff happened. So it would be nice to see Roma up there and challenging, but I just. You can't see anything other than it imploding again next season, because that's what he does. That's who he is, you know. I can't see anything other than some sort of a divorce happening around about December time, as usual.
I think no matter what, it's going to be compelling viewing. You know, there's something utterly, utterly hypnotic about a Mourinho kind of implosion. But even then, you know, if he doesn't deliver us that and he actually does something tangible next season with what is, you know, a pretty talented and, you know, Roma side, then, you know, I think we kind of get some entertainment either end of that spectrum. Moving on to the Europa Conference final, Aidan, West Ham United have finally cracked the code, the trophy-winning code, after 43 years.
43 years is a very short time to be without a trophy, I would say.
They're just amateurs, aren't they, in the great scheme of things. But yes, West Ham, though, you know, that good value for their success, their win in Prague.
Yes, I think so. There's something very pleasing about a last-minute winner as well. It's kind of satisfying because it's a bit like the golden goal extra time back in the day. It wasn't quite final, but it feels it. Our pal Adam Somerton borrowed a bit of Brian Moore commentary, didn't he, of it being up for grabs now. But then we had the amusing 5 or 6 minutes after that of every time the ball was cleared. And this will be it now. Just one more attack to repel. And then a couple of minutes later, just one more attack to repel. It seemed to be going on and on, allowing more and more time to hopefully not to let Fiorentina score. But, you know, it seemed that way momentarily. It was quite entertaining in some regard. I think West Ham were good value. I think it was an odd one in that each team seemed to have their best spells after they'd scored rather than leading up to it. I think Fiorentina, when they equalised, it wasn't too long after West Ham had scored, but they had their best spell following that rather than before, and they looked quite dangerous. There were some unfortunate incidents, of course, the cut to the head for the same, I forget his name, but he ended up giving away the penalty and misplacing or letting things through for the final flourish as well, I think. So that was a bit unfortunate. I think the other misfortune for West Ham is that this finest moment and glory will be forever etched in that awful kit that they were wearing. I think, you know, you're going to be seeing pictures and images of that forever as a West Ham fan, and it's going to be in that kit. I don't know. That can't be good. That can't be good. So they lose a few marks for me on that one. But what can you do? I think the winning goal, a lovely, lovely through pass from Paqueta, perfectly timed as Bowen had set off. Your first instinct was, oh, are they going to bring this back? Because, of course, we can't wholly celebrate a goal in the modern days when you think it might be questionable. So they had to check. Bowen did his best to fluff it and miss as well. I think the goalie probably could have saved it. It wasn't the best of finishes, but who cares, really? It went in right in front of the West Ham fans as well. Ecstatic celebrations. I thought the celebrations afterwards showed a real connection between those players and their fans. I think Declan Rice, he seems an all-round nice guy to me. I was really pleased for him. West Ham aren't a team I've ever managed to have much love for. For some reason, I don't know why. It's just one of those teams I've just never liked in particular. But Declan Rice, I like him. And I think seeing him celebrate with his family, seeing what it meant to him to sort of sign off as a West Ham player by lifting only, well, by becoming only their third captain to lift a trophy, I think, joining great names of the past, their first one in 43 years. That was really pleasing to see, kind of heartwarming in a way. I think for West Ham, they've embraced the Conference League and really gone for it. And we talked earlier about going for glory versus trying to finish a couple of places higher in the league. West Ham have struggled this season. David Moyes has struggled this season. He could have been sacked. The club showed a bit of faith in him, and boy, has he repaid them. But they, as a team, have embraced the Conference League. They've gone for it, where many teams, I guess it's more Europa League in the past, and Conference League pretty new, but they've seen it as an irritant rather than something to be enjoyed, embraced, and to actually be a chance of glory. Okay, sure, there's lots of teams in these competitions, so, you know, glory is a long way off at times. But it's an adventure that doesn't come around very often for a club like West Ham, or hasn't come around very often for a club like West Ham and other clubs of that stature. But we've seen clubs of that stature or similar have European campaigns and not really bother, treat it as something that's just they have to get through for a couple of rounds before they can just exit and get back to their mundane attempts to finish 16th or 17th. I don't see the fun in that. There's no glory in that. I'm not inspired by that. whereas West Ham have actually gone for it here. Fiorentina too. And they've got their reward for doing it. David Moyes is another one. He's hard to love at times, but I'm really, really pleased for him. I found myself being absolutely delighted for him. To see him charging down the touchline when they scored that winner was magnificent. It's probably just as well he didn't try the knee slide, as he explained. He might have toppled over. And to see his dancing at the end, well, I mean, that was, I don't want to say beautiful. It was interesting, but it was entertaining. It was hugely memorable. But, you know, that just showed what it meant to him. He's had a career of more than 1,000 games, I think, in charge of various teams. Done very well at some clubs and less at others. But, you know, he's always been a strong manager. And for him to finally get a piece of silverware after all that time, in a season where he nearly lost his job, where he's much maligned, I thought that was terrific. I thought that was really good to see. So his celebrations, I thought, were wonderful. So that was really good. I think this competition as well. I know, Stephen, you've obviously studied the Cup Winners' Cup and loved the Cup Winners' Cup from days past. I think there are echoes of that in this Conference League now, in terms of the slight randomness of the teams that seem to make their way through. It doesn't quite come about in the same way, so it's not quite the same. But I think there are echoes, and I think it's been quite fun for those that have fully embraced it. And West Ham and their fans certainly have. So for all my West Ham antipathy, I was actually delighted for them.
David Moyes. Yeah, well, what more can be said there? You know, I think Aidan nails it there in that, you know, even me as a Liverpool supporter, looking at someone who's managed not just Everton but Manchester United as well, both on his CV, you know, you couldn't help but be, at the very least, even if you were anti-West Ham for the final, even if you were, you know, frowning at the projectiles being thrown onto the pitch by a section of the supporters, you know, whatever it is that turns you off about West Ham, surely, you know, it would take the coldest of hearts not to be, you know, delighted for David Moyes.
Yeah, I agree with all the stuff that Aidan said and that you've said. I mean, you know, I think you can safely say that David Moyes has paid his dues over the years. It was nice. I mean, he's fortunate at his age to still have his dad there to be able to celebrate with as well, which was lovely, really, to see all that. And I think a bigger thing for West Ham, I mean, you know, they've never really taken to that move away from Upton Park, the supporters, and they've never really felt at home in that London Stadium and all of that. And we've all got our views on the London Stadium and whether they should be allowed to be playing in that and all of those kinds of things. But I suppose as a football club, maybe that's a healing kind of thing for them to have finally won this. To have taken this competition seriously in the way that they have over the last 2 years, you know, semi-final last year, final this year, winning it. I think that's a great thing. It goes back to all the stuff we've said about, you know, glory and having your photos around the stadium and all of that sort of stuff. What is amazing is, you know, there are still, if you look on Twitter and stuff, it's still, well, David Moyes done a fantastic job. Now it's time that we got rid of him, we've got a proper manager. I'm always loath to criticise supporters of another football club for wanting to get rid of a manager or whatever, because they see him every week. You know, they know the ins and outs of it. And they, more than that, they pay their money. You know, I mean, I'm sure Aidan spent many, many, many months being fairly tired of how everybody had that loving with Steve Bruce, while the Newcastle supporters weren't having a loving with Steve Bruce. It just seems to me, you got to be careful what you wish for with moving on from David Moyes if that was what you were going to do. Because, you know, I mean, they finished sixth and seventh. And then, okay, this year they didn't have a great season in the league, but, you know, they finished up 40-odd points and they were comfortably safe. They had two fantastic European seasons. What else do you want as a West Ham supporter? We're all ambitious for our football club. We all want more things. We all want to be better and all of that. But when you look at the landscape of the Premier League, well, are West Ham going to break into that top seven? You'd think not, really, on a regular basis. Just, again, going back to all the things we've said earlier on about money and resources and all of those things, I mean, if, as a West Ham fan, you must have had two or three fantastic years. You've been all over Europe. You've beaten clubs all over Europe. You got to a semi-final. You've gone to a final. You've won something. You've picked a trophy up for the first time in 40-odd years. And you think you might get a better manager to do something else. I don't know. West Ham are going to change now because obviously Declan Rice is on his way. And that's going to make an enormous difference to what happens at West Ham. I know lots of West Ham supporters say that they didn't spend their money particularly well last summer in the transfer market. And they fear that if they get a lot of money for Declan Rice, they won't spend it well again this season. I can take that point, but I mean, it would take something to shift David Moyes out, wouldn't it? I mean, to sack him after all of that, I don't know. That would be some call, wouldn't it? Unless you've got some genius sitting there waiting, ready to come in, and I don't know who that genius is, to be perfectly honest.
I mean, Aidan, from a West Ham perspective, behind the scenes, they wouldn't want to be the club that moves David Moyes on, brings someone else in who's an abject failure, and then be pointed at as being the man, the club that got rid of a trophy-winning manager, the first trophy-winning manager they've had in 4.5 decades, for someone else. In a way, the ball is totally in David Moyes' court there. We mentioned earlier on about how, the stock of Italian teams and the players that they've got, if they're coveted by, other clubs, then they'll have to pay a bigger premium than they were doing, a year or two ago. In a way, David Moyes suddenly becomes an attractive proposition for other clubs. You've got Crystal Palace not a million miles away from where West Ham are sat, yet to appoint a new manager. I'm sure that David Moyes would walk into another job, probably more so now than at any point in the last two or three years. But I mean, then he was leading to high league positions and Europa League qualification, Europa League semi-final last year. He is suddenly the godfather of British pragmatism, as you know.
He's certainly sitting pretty at the moment because, yes, if they were stupid enough to get rid of one of the few managers to have ever won a trophy for West Ham, then, yeah, he will be fine. He will be fine. He'll find another club, another challenge, I'm quite sure, because his stock is high. It was high when he was taking Everton to fourth and fifth regularly, and which led, of course, to the Manchester United job. It's been in several deep lows, and it was low earlier this season, but right now it's very high. And if that was his sign off, if they did get rid of him, then that is a high point for him, and he will be fine. He'll find something else, and he'll probably have similar struggles and may take them to decent achievements as well. Who knows? But West Ham, as Dave said, what do they expect? They may have ambitions for loftier positions in the league. Given they have this stadium that they haven't had to pay for, given the amount of income they must generate from match day revenue and so on, given their position in the capital city, of course, which I'm sure we all utterly disagree, but it seems that that's a stereotypical thing about foreign players wanting to go only to London at times. They have all these things in their favour. They could push on and get higher. Do they have realistic ambitions of becoming a regular top four side? Maybe the boardroom do, but it doesn't seem particularly realistic at the moment, given their ownership and the ownership of the teams they'd be up against, I should put it that way. So that seems unlikely. So this kind of success is as good as it should get for them. David Moyes he's now a West Ham legend. That seems a weird thing to say, but he is. It's utterly, utterly bizarre. You would never have thought it a few months ago, but he absolutely is. So I think he's earned the right to carry on. I say that with a slight caveat because it smacks of at times where you see a caretaker manager do well in a short spell, and then the club feels compelled to keep them on, give them a permanent deal, and then it all goes sour. And maybe it will go sour for Moyes and West Ham next season. Maybe they'll continue to struggle in the league, and maybe they won't do particularly well in the Europa League now that they're in. Who knows? But I think to have had your finest moment in decades and one of the finest in the club's long history, I think you'd be foolish to just cast aside the person who'd led you to that, regardless of the issues that may have happened earlier in the season. I think they'd be mad to do so, but I don't think they will. I think he will still be there at the start of next season. He'll still be dour. His football will still be uninspiring. The team will be a bit iffy and they'll probably struggle a bit. But he is and will forever be a West Ham legend now.
In the opposite dugout, Dave, Vincenzo Italiano, maybe the unluckiest manager in Serie A this season. He took Fiorentina to the Coppa Italia final that they lost to Inter narrowly. You know, the chance was there in the palm of the hand to win it, and they lost out. And then they've lost late in the game in the Europa Conference League final. Yet, despite all that, and you know, finishing, you know, was it eighth or so? I think it was in Serie A. He has been spoken of as a potential successor to Luciano Spalletti at Napoli. You know, one of a few, Thiago Motta, who's produced some fantastic football with Bologna. Certainly in the second half of this season, and reputedly talking to Paolo Sousa, the Salernitana coach, who turned things around so well this season as well. You know, you've got to kind of like doff your cap to him. His reaction on the bench to the winning goal was understandably a stark contrast to David Moyes.
Yes, he didn't. He didn't attack your court as well. Yeah, I mean, some years it's not your year, is it? I mean, I thought that game could have gone either way, to be honest. The final, well, both finals could have gone either way. Yeah, I don't think West Ham would have had too many complaints had he gone to extra time, and the Fiorentina had gone on with it. I mean, it was a really finely balanced game. I think that was the attraction of it, really. But yeah, he's had a couple of two or three great seasons there, hasn't he? I mean, he did really well at Spezia, taking them up, and then having a good season last year in Serie A before he moved on to Fiorentina. And you know, he put together a decent side there. He's got to be in the running for one of those higher up jobs. But there's always a thing about, you know, it's easy to move on and get yourself into the glamour job. But maybe there's value in having a couple of years somewhere and doing the same good job again next season. And maybe winning that Coppa Italia next season, or, you know, going one further. A lot of really promising careers, managerial coaching careers, have been ruined by jumping that little bit too early. I wonder if maybe, you know, another year in Florence wouldn't be a bad thing for him. But you could see why Napoli would be attracted to somebody like him, because he is one of those coaches on the way up. He's, what is he, mid-40s, I think? He's done his apprenticeship, if you like. He's put together a team that plays, you know, decent football. I could see why they would be interested in him. It'd certainly be Fiorentina's loss if he were to go, because he's done a great job this season. But the next sort of 4 or 5 weeks in Serie A is going to be interesting, because once one moves, that'll then just be the dominoes going, you know, right across the division. Juventus might well be changing manager. You know, I mean, there's a lot of talk about Allegri. They're not wild about his second spell there. Maybe that job's open for somebody as well. So it'll be interesting. It'll be an interesting summer in Serie A, I think.
I mean, Aiden, Fiorentina, I don't know, they've had four decades, certainly, you know, since I've known them, the existence of them, the vast majority of the time they've been preyed upon by the bigger beasts in Serie A. It wouldn't be a surprise to see someone swoop in for the manager and see a clutch of those players that have sent them onto this final suddenly disappear into the horizon.
Yeah, they're one of those mid-ranking teams that are big but not big enough, if you like, to be able to hang on to these people. I quite enjoyed their manager. I think it was a real live wire. There's something quite entertaining of seeing someone like that on the sidelines. And yes, he probably is destined for bigger things. It's a shame. I really like Fiorentina. I've always liked them. I guess it's the colour. and some of the players they've had in the past, from Baggio, Battistuta, and all of that, they were always sort of big in the Football Italia, early years of Football Italia. And I think that sort of adds to their allure for someone in my age. It would have been nice to see them win. It would be nice to see them win something. you outlined their misfortune this season, which is a shame. It's But again, I think they're of similar stature to West Ham. And I think that's part of the situation, the reality of it. You know, West Ham are losing their iconic player in Declan Rice. And Fiorentina may well lose similar or their manager. And that, unfortunately, is the reality. Teams of this stature who do well, who have success, they are then taken apart by bigger entities who pick off and cherry pick the best bits. It's a shame because it would be nice to have a bit of variety. And that's where this competition has done well. Like I say, it has allowed a bit of variety in terms of teams reaching top European finals. And that's a good thing. That can only be a good thing. But you wouldn't be surprised if it's a different couple of teams next year and a different couple of teams the year after that, because a little hint of success for teams of this level and they can get picked apart easily by the bigger beasts, unfortunately.
Indeed. Looking forward to next season. Obviously, there's a big summer of transfers and probably managerial merry-go-rounds to deal with. But from English football's perspective, Dave, that's what Manchester City, Arsenal, Manchester United, Newcastle in the Champions League, Liverpool, West Ham and Brighton in the Europa League, and Aston Villa in the Conference League. Can you see any, you know, obviously Manchester City are going to be going into it as the reigning European champions, West Ham as conference winners will be going into the Europa League. Can you see glory afoot for any English clubs next season?
Wouldn't have thought West Ham were thrilled at the prospect of Liverpool being in the same European competition as them next season, to be perfectly honest. If you're putting your money down there, you'd have Liverpool as favourites for that Europa League. I mean, Liverpool will be back next season to the same sort of standards that we've become used to the last 4 or 5 years, I would think. And certainly you would think they'd have too much for a lot of teams in that Europa League. As Aidan said earlier, I think Villa is an interesting one in the Conference League. I mean, they've got the right manager. He knows his way around that competition, and they had such a good second half of the season after we all started up again after the World Cup. So I think they've got to be in there with a proper shout. And as we said right at the start, you know, because you were saying, Stephen, the Manchester City now, great, you've won it once. Now, do you want to be classed as a really proper team? You know, do you want to be classed as a real giant of a team? Well, go and do it again. That's the test of the great teams in European level. They've got to go and do it again. Will the players be hungry enough? Who knows? You know, will any move on? Who will come in? All that kind of stuff. That's the interest. But Manchester City have got to have a good chance next season. I mean, they are the best team in Europe. At the moment, the right team won the competition in that sense. You would have to see them going deep into the competition again next season. Of course, Newcastle, maybe deliberately finishing third to go and have a crack at the Europa League.
I mean, Aidan, your thoughts on Newcastle's prospects for next season?
Well, yes, I think their European prospects are probably not too great. Certainly not in the Champions League. I think they've overachieved this season for what any plan may or may not have been in terms of where they've ended up. Therefore, I think it's a step too far. There's quite a lot of catching up to do, I would think. The squad is certainly not big enough at that quality to be able to cope for too much. So potentially their league form may suffer a little bit with the Champions League going on as well. Who knows? They'll get a tough group draw, that's for sure, because they'll be in the bottom pot of seeds as they should, because they haven't been in Europe for quite some time. Their coefficient, if we're getting all into all the UEFA stuff, will be very low. So they'll have tough draws. The plus of that is that Newcastle's first Champions League campaign in a couple of decades will or should see a couple of Europe's finest come along to St. James's, and that would be, you know, I'm going to say no disrespect. It is complete disrespect to other teams if we had a group with Maccabi Haifa, Ludogorets and Basel or something like that. You know, that's not going to be as entertaining as getting Real Madrid, Napoli and Bayern, whatever it might be. Yeah. Well, let's see if that one comes out. But it will be very, very difficult. maybe finishing third, as we said, wouldn't be such a bad idea. But I think, yes, as Dave says, I agree, Liverpool will be strong contenders when it comes to the Europa League and City as well. I wouldn't be surprised to see two English winners this time next year. I'm really interested to see how Brighton get on. Again, talking of teams of that level, they're already being picked apart. The Giants of Liverpool have stolen McAllister from them, but Brighton have had this several times already and have never blinked. They've progressed. It's next man in, and they've kept going and kept achieving and improving, if anything. So with some of the players they've got some other great young South American players. Enciso was looking fantastic at the end of last season, another gem that they've found. Kaoru Matoma is another fabulous player. They've got some excellent, excellent players, and it makes you confident that they would wisely invest the money they're getting for McAllister and anyone else who may leave, and they'll push them on. I hope they get to keep their manager. As you talked about with Fiorentina, De Zerbi has looked absolutely fabulous with Brighton, and I'm sure there are plenty of clubs casting envious glances his way. Clubs who might have greater resource than Brighton and might have loftier ambitions. I really hope he gets to stay there for another season and gets to lead them into Europe, because I think he'd be very, very good at coaching them through the Europe, through the group stages and beyond. So yeah, I'm really, really intrigued to see how Brighton get on. I think that will be quite fascinating, and I hope they do quite well without probably not troubling the final end game, because Liverpool and a few clubs who probably drop out of the Champions League will be the ones in the mix there. But no, it's a good mix of clubs. It has changed around a bit from it's being same so often, to see both Liverpool and Tottenham miss out on the top four, and Chelsea, of course, in spectacular style, is, you know, that's good in a way. Arsenal have claimed a place back in it. Newcastle have now got in it for a bit of variety. There's West Ham and Brighton again, and Villa. It's a good mix. It's a change. It's nice. And change is good. It shouldn't just be the same all the time. So I'm sure you were frustrated to miss out on the top four, Stephen. But I think overall, it's nice to have that mix. And it gives Liverpool a different thing to go for. One that, again, had Liverpool made in the top four, I don't think we would have necessarily been talking to them as contenders for victory, but we are for the Europa League.
Indeed, indeed. I mean, from a Liverpool supporter's perspective, you know, we simply didn't deserve to be in there for the full range of the season we put in. You know, a great run in, but we finished where we deserve to. I agree, Brighton are going to be a fascinating prospect. And yes, Aston Villa will be intriguing. Unai Emery, who, you know, has loved the Europa League so much. It'd be interesting to see what he can do with Aston Villa, who seem to be moving quite quick in the transfer market so far this season. They reputedly on the brink of snapping up Youri Tielemans on a free from Leicester, and there is talk of them snapping up Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain as well. So, you know, already strengthening their hand with some clever free transfers there for out of contract Premier League midfielders, Premier League quality midfielders. But yes, it will be fascinating, as this season has been in so many respects as well. Thank you, Dave, for your contributions tonight.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for hosting things, and I think you'll agree. It's been wonderful to have Aidan back with us.
It has indeed. But yes, thank you, Aidan, for your Luis Diaz style return.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. It's good to be back, as the song once went.
Brilliant, brilliant stuff. That's it for these football times for this season. We will be back with the regular weekly podcast come the start of next season, probably early August, in the build up to the new seasons. It doesn't mean that the podcast will be down completely. There will be output as the weeks go on. We have a few book podcasts coming up and a couple of series is on the horizon. So, you know, plenty to listen to while the football's down the summer, unless you're going full on hipster and taking up a summer league and, you know, watching a bit of J-League or the Orphan Scan or something like that, you know, which, you know, is always the theory at my house, but, you know, theory doesn't always meet the practicalities of the situation. But all I could left to say is thank you for listening and goodbye. This has been the Lob Podcast, today's Football Times via These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.